Before we begin this week's episode with two incredible researchers bringing us new information around weight bias in maternity care, I want to do a brief trigger warning. Some of the messaging that came out of this research is heart-wrenching and can absolutely be triggering, including one of the researchers' own personal stories. So when we talk about these topics around weight bias, we know that sometimes it can be difficult. And if this isn't the right episode for you to listen to now, that's okay. We have many others. But if you're ready, here we go. Hi, friends, and welcome to the Plus Mommy Podcast. I'm your host, Jen McClellan, and here we explore plus-size pregnancy, motherhood, and body love. From bumps to bellies, we talk about it all. Now, let's get started. Hi, friends. Today, we are joined by two incredible humans that are hopefully putting out information into the world that is going to help transform how plus-size people are treated, not only through pregnancy and postpartum, but also fertility. I am honored to be joined by Dr. Margaret Quinlan and Dr. Erin Basinger. They are both doctorates in communication studies, professors at UMC Charlotte, and people who I am just delighted to have this conversation with. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this is a real honor. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I'd love to start by just hearing from you both, Erin and Maggie, of what made you even want to dig into this research. We've known for, you know, decades now, we've had research around weight bias, but not weight bias in pregnancy and birth and postpartum until just the most recent few years, which has been so shocking for me as someone who's been doing this work for over a decade. But now there seems to be a lot more interest and it's very exciting. So what made you want to focus on looking at how people are being treated during this time?
That's a great question. This was, to use a birth analogy, a real love child of Maggie's and my research, because Maggie is an expert on parenting, pregnancy, infertility, motherhood, parenthood, and I have studied stigma and particularly weight stigma for several years. And Maggie and I are colleagues, but we're also dear friends. And in having conversations about our research, we found this point of intersection that felt really important to both of us, but also was, as you noted, Jen, really understudied. And so it came out of that set of interests, but also my own experiences as a fat woman navigating the reproductive healthcare system. And Maggie, as my dear friend, was enraged by my experiences. And this was a way for us to explore some of that with an eye toward advocacy in a way that we used our expertise. And so it was personal and it was professional. And it was friendship. It was all of those things.
I love it. Erin, could you tell us a little bit about, before we started recording, I know your story and I was cursing about it because it makes me so enraged. But I think it'll help people because we're like, oh, there's researchers on the podcast. This is going to be highly academic. And am I going to understand anything? So let's first, and we will, because I also said you guys write and report in a way that is so easy to understand. And I hope because of that, it helps to pull your research out into the world even stronger. But I think by putting that personal touch on what we experience, those of us who exist in larger bodies, to the point that it is, we could die, right? And I'll, of course, have plenty of trigger warnings at the top of this episode. But could you share some of your story with us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I, for many years, have had negative interactions as a fat woman with healthcare providers in general, but with reproductive healthcare providers more specifically. And the mind boggles at some of the things we hear as fat people seeking reproductive healthcare. But some of that really started in earnest when my husband and I were considering trying to get pregnant. And so I had my IUD removed, and that provider said, we need to have a frank discussion about my weight, which all fat people listening to this know exactly what came next. So she told me I would have trouble getting pregnant. She told me I would have trouble staying pregnant, that it would take a long time for me to conceive. I was pregnant 5 weeks later and had a baby who was healthy and happy after that. So I, in spite of a lot of the really negative interactions I had with providers, had a healthy, happy pregnancy. And I think it's important to note that from the top, that is yes. possible and also incredibly common. It's just
very
not,
common. Studies show.
Yeah, it's just not the discourse we hear from our providers. I was treated pretty poorly, I would say, the whole time I was pregnant by my own providers. They told me I couldn't gain more than 19 pounds or something, or else I would have to deliver in a different hospital that was not as nice as the one that they typically deliver in, but it has a NICU attached, and it was sort of guaranteed if you gain this much weight, your baby will need to be in the NICU. And so always that was kind of hanging over my head. The bigger issue was, when you're pregnant, you are checked all the time. All the time, your body is poked and prodded and checked. And so my lymph nodes were checked in addition to everything else at the beginning, middle, and end of my pregnancy. And during none of those appointments were any concerns raised. About 6 months after I gave birth to my son, I went to the doctor about some swelling under my arm. Some swelling that it turned out to be in my lymph nodes. And I, at that, you know, after about a month, I was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that my doctors had missed. Of course, there's no way to know exactly why they missed it. There's a lot going on during pregnancy. And at the same time, they didn't find something that was very clearly a problem. My suspicion, as somebody who does a lot of weight stigma research, is that they missed it because there's fat under this woman's arm and she's fat, so it's probably just fat.
Yeah.
Of course, I'll never know the answer to that, but I think it's very likely that fat phobia had something to do with it. So when my son was 7 months old, I was diagnosed with cancer. I started chemo when he was 8 months old. That was last year. I was in remission starting in, as of July 2022, I was in remission. So all of this is pretty recent. And I thankfully am okay. That is not the case for some people. This is literally life or death for some people. So I didn't know about any of that when Maggie and I started this project. We started envisioning this project and collecting the data actually right around the time that I got pregnant.
Wow.
So we had no idea what was coming down the pike for me personally. But this story and this research became so much more than an academic endeavor for us. Because yeah. of my personal journey that happened while we were writing these studies up. And so it's deeply personal for both of us. And we feel really passionate about getting this information out in honor of our participants and also so that people don't have the same experiences that I did in the reproductive healthcare system.
Wow. I would definitely echo that your suspicions of why it wasn't caught, that you literally had cancer and swollen lymph nodes during pregnancy, was absolutely white bias. Mm-hmm. And it's a prime example of how everything is just blamed on the person's size and not looking at any underlying concerns, and that people are literally dying. And I am so thankful to hear that you are in remission and doing better. And I know that your story has been picked up by some big media outlets that are hopefully is propelling your research even further. I wish you never had to go through it. But I know that it's, you know, it gives this even deeper level, right? Like I'm reading through all your research, and then you're like, oh, Jen, there's this other article that we can also talk about. And I was like, okay. So I go to read, and I was like, oh my goodness. Like it ties everything together, right? We have this evidence to show that people are being mistreated. And here's like one of this main researcher on this project with people who care about her doing this work with her, seeing you go through it, Maggie, I can only imagine as a friend that exists in a, you know, smaller body, seeing your friend and your colleague go through something like this and tying together everything that you're hearing from all participants, which overwhelmingly was gut-wrenching to evaluate. So Maggie, why don't you share a little bit about what it was like to do this research while supporting your friend going through what everything Erin did?
Well, I think, you know, it definitely made me really reflect on the thin privilege that I have. And
yeah,
I have two children who are 8 and 5. And so I was, you know, a little ahead of Erin in the reproductive stage. And, you know, and I look back at, you know, even some of the messages that I probably said to Erin that, you know, probably weren't supportive, that I just, you know, didn't know. I was like, oh, you'll have no trouble. You know, you'll be fine. Or, you know, I got pregnant really fast. You will, you know, I mean, I probably said a lot that I shouldn't have said. And I think what really shocked me was how ingrained the, like, even the language of obesity was throughout the previous literature. And I remember when Erin was working on the literature review, she had to take a break from it because it was just so, you know, so offensive. And, you know, just, mm-hmm. we don't even use the word obesity. Like, that's just not, you know, not a term that we use throughout our research. And I think we really expected to have pushback from communication journals, from women's health journals, and we didn't at all. Like, we found that people were really, really, really supportive of the language that we were using, the framework, and we can talk a little bit about our memorable message framework, that, you know, people really were excited about it. And I think what was even more encouraging was we posted, Erin had just found out she was pregnant, and so it was a just bad timing for her to be posting on social media that, hey, you know, I'm like, you know, a week in here. And, you know, she just didn't want to out herself so early on, especially, you know, because living in a fat body means she's going to miscarry that much, you know, more higher chances, which is just ridiculous. You know, so I was doing all of the posting on different Facebook groups and listservs. And within a week, we got over 250 people responded. And I think we were both blown away because we, you know, I kind of expected we'd have to do multiple, you know, rounds to try to get people to complete the survey. And there was just such a high demand for people to want to share their stories. And so it was really motivated me to want to keep doing this research. And, you know, Erin and I already have another study planned, you know, just to sort of keep the questions going, because, you know, one study leads to another. And I could see myself, you know, definitely working in this area for a long time based on how powerful the messages that we heard were.
Yes, yes. And I hope you both continue to do so. So let's dive into the research. And I also have a note here because I noticed, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm reading through this. And yes, it was triggering as a person in a larger body to read it, but I didn't see the word obese and obesity every other sentence, which was really kind of nice to not, because we know the definition for the word obesity is to eat oneself to fatness. And it's just so just polarizing and just makes you feel like crap. And yet, you know, we have such a defensiveness from the medical community that said, well, this is a medical term. Well, this is an offensive term. And I think people are hearing loud and clear that it is. So the fact that you chose to go with a lot of, you said, use the word fat a lot and people in larger bodies, I appreciate it as a fat person. So thank you for that. So your study that we'll talk about first was memorable messages about fat bodies before, during, and after pregnancy. For the listeners, can you please spend just a little time explaining what memorable messages are?
Sure. So memorable messages, that term comes from a theoretical framework, the theory of memorable messages, and talks about particular types of messages. One of my favorite ways that they talk about memorable messages is they say memorable messages are ones that are sticky. And so they're ones that stay with you over the long term. They're messages that are stored in our long-term memory. Often they come from people who have more power over us, formally or informally. They're often shorter messages, but they're ones that we store because they tend to have some kind of impact on our identity, our emotional state, our behavior, our self-concept. And so when you think about memorable messages like that, it's not too hard to come up with one from our own lives. You know, as I say, think about a message about your body that was really important to you when you were young. Often we can come up with those, particularly people who have been fat for a lot of their lives. And so people have used the memorable messages framework in a lot of different contexts. Many of them are health oriented. And so when we asked about it here, we asked people, what was a message about your body that you got before, during, and after pregnancy that stuck with you over time? And people had no problem identifying them.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, you ended up having 259 participants, but as you went through the online study, you walked away with 249 participants. And overwhelmingly, you did find that there was, what, it was 77.2% of the memorable messages during pregnancy, birth, and postpartum were negative. Now, that is of no surprise to me. And I don't want to speak for Erin, but I'm going to say likely she's nodding, not a big surprise. But Maggie, what about for you? Was this surprising at all?
No, I don't think I expected to get happy messages. You know, I didn't. I think what I was almost more surprised was how in the last theme we talk about some of the counter narratives of, you know, some of the negative messages. So, you know, the more empowering ones and some of the really beautiful ones came from partners. And, you know, that was a very encouraging, you know, just that the partners knew enough to say things like, you are so beautiful and you've never looked so, you know, beautiful, you're going to be a great mom, you know, all those like really powerful messages. And, you know, we learned that it takes a lot of positive messages to sort of overcome or disrupt all of the negative messages that individuals receive. And so, you know, it was just a reminder to me to be somebody that says the positive messages to people, you know, not just in fat bodies, but, you know, of all different diverse bodies, right? That those messages really do have an impact. And I think it's easy to forget that. And so I think I wasn't surprised by the negative, but encouraged by some of the positive ones.
I love that. I love that our first talk about it was that there was some positive that came out of it and that it was, you know, that partner support. I also noted, you know, pregnancy seemed to be overwhelmingly negative messages were memorable. Labor and delivery had some more positive and the postpartum was negative. And I wonder, as we'll talk more, I wonder if that's because we know that people need to be feel supported while birthing their children. So nurses and care providers are more likely in those situations to say positive things, which almost reinforced their base knowledge that when we treat people with dignity and compassion, they will feel supported and they can have outcomes, healthy outcomes. I found that was really, really interesting as I was digging into the responses of when we saw more negative, positive, and then more negative. It's almost like we know this all. We know that people are being mistreated. We know that horrible things are being said to people, but and we know that they're not effective, right? And I feel like overwhelmingly, care providers know this too, but so much of their own bias clearly comes out when supporting people of size. So, Erin, I'll turn the mic over to you. But those were some thoughts that I had immediately after reading through and digging through what came out of your study.
Yeah, I do think one important note to make for listeners is that in memorable messages research, we don't always see negative messages as the ones people remember. And so when you ask people, what messages do you remember about school growing up or about your relationship with your parents, we often see way more positive than negative messages. And so the fact that we saw an overwhelming majority of negative messages is actually very striking because that's not always happening. I thought, same as you, Jen, I thought you know, it's great that we're seeing more positive messages during labor and delivery than negative ones. It wasn't a huge percentage. You know, I think it was 50-something percent were positive. So it was more, but not like all the messages were positive. And I also thought, well, I mean, that's a low bar to clear that we're not shitting on people for being fat while they're actively getting a baby out of their body.
Oh, you know? Gosh.
Like, yeah, I guess if we're going to lay off for this 48 hours, that's good. But also, we really shouldn't be doing this before or after either. So I sort of looked at it as like, this is good. We can do much better than this.
A bazillion percent. So let's look at kind of the four different takeaways that you had in your study from looking at these memorable messages. And I mean, this really was hard to read through. I mean, it was so well written and I appreciated it. It was hard to read through, even though none of it was surprising to me. But, you know, really looking at just the bad mother, that was one of the first takeaways that people kind of felt that they were bad. Even I noted that feeling of maternal fatness is the origin of the obesity epidemic. I was like, I could understand. Like, I feel like I carry that weight, I guess pun intended, as a mom of size, with how I'm made to feel by care providers and society that, well, you shouldn't even had a child as a fat person because now, you know, you're contributing to this epidemic. And it just is like, so basically you're saying that people with a BMI above 30 shouldn't be allowed to get pregnant and have families. Like, and that is so often how people are made to feel. And now we have this study proving these ways that we're made to feel from our own childhood to becoming parents ourselves.
Well, and I think too, now, you know, even with all of the new AAP guidelines, right, that just thinking about how children are going to be raised under these guidelines. And so they're going to be getting these messages even younger than we would have received, and how that's going to impact their experiences, you know, with trying to conceive, pregnancy, childbirth, postpartum. You know, it's the trickle down effect of, you know, different mandates or different decisions are really going to impact this next generation in scary ways. And, you know, just thinking about, you know, being told, right, that, you know, your body isn't suited for pregnancy or parenthood, that, you know, that even being in a fat body is dangerous or deadly or could cause a miscarriage or a stillbirth. You know, I don't even have the right word, right, for how harsh those messages are. And, you know, just thinking like some individuals in our study were praised, you know, for being a better mother because they, you know, tried to lose weight or only gained a little bit of weight during pregnancy. And, you know, I mean, I think there's enough messages for all of us, no matter our size, you know, that we receive about all the ways that we're bad mothers, right? I even wrote a book called You're Doing It Wrong, right? We're all, you know, we get a million messages a day about how, you know, how we're doing things wrong. And then, you know, to live in a body that's already seen as, you know, being a bad mother before you even start, like a, I think it was a husband saying when there was a baby lost, that the husband said, you know, I'm glad you lost the baby. I never thought you would be a good mother anyway. I mean, that quote, I mean, how do you ever recover from that? It would be years of therapy just in that one statement alone. So.
You don't. Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for bringing up the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, their new guidelines on how to treat obesity in children, the use of medication and even weight loss surgery recommendations that has really shocked so many of us. So thank you for bringing that up. Erin, what are your thoughts on that first theme takeaway of fat mothers or bad mothers?
Yeah, some of the really excellent critical scholars that came before us gave us a really fantastic framework for thinking about this. So like what you mentioned, Jen, about maternal obesity being kind of the root of all our social problems, that comes from people like George Parker and Kat Pazé and Rodriguez, which you mentioned earlier, who are just fantastic thinkers who have published quite a bit on this topic. And so we are really indebted to them for giving us a way to think about this. As a fat mother myself, it's horrifying to think about. Yeah. It's rage-inducing. I think for a lot of people, though, that would be very shame-inducing. And that, to me, is such a huge problem. You know, those of us who are part of the fat liberation movement are able to see that and not internalize it, at least not immediately, you know. But there was a time 10 years ago when I would have heard that and just fallen into a hole of shame. And yeah. So the reason that I think some of this work is so important for us to do is so we get the message out that this is not you. You are not the problem. The problem is the structures and systems that have decided that, quote, obesity is an illness, that medicalized fatness, when fatness is just a regular state of being, like being tall or anything, having brown hair or whatever it is. I heard Aubrey Gordon say on her podcast Maintenance Phase recently, I don't think fat people are an epidemic. I think we're a gift. You're welcome. And I just thought, what a beautiful way to talk about this. And I think us being able to put language to, you are not a problem, you are a gift to the world, yeah. is really important for fat people, fat mothers to hear.
I hope everyone listening like heard that and hit the rewind button real quick there on your podcast to hear your podcast app to hear it again, because it's so incredibly important. And you mentioned Rodriguez, and we've had her on the podcast before to share her incredible research around weight bias in maternity care, which was one of the first looks specifically at weight bias in maternity care. And I'll put her episode in the show notes as well. So the first theme takeaway was that fat moms are bad moms, which leads directly into the second, which was denial of competent treatment. And this is something I hear so often from people in my community, that they weren't given access to things that, from their understanding and research, were and are evidence-based because of their size. And I feel like when we're told and led to believe that we are bad and we're wrong and our bodies are going to fail, it is very hard to advocate for the treatment that we deserve. So let's talk a bit about that second theme that you saw of denial of competent treatment.
Yeah, so here what we saw was a lot of providers not trusting fat people to know their bodies. And that is something that comes up very commonly in research about fat bodies in general, is you can't possibly know your own body because look at it. And so we saw a lot of providers not trusting people when they were in labor, not trusting that something was wrong, not trusting that they needed something in particular. There are in this section, Jen, I'm sure you noticed, some very extreme examples. There is mention of a baby loss in this section, and we really debated about whether to include those in our paper because they are horrific. Yeah, they are also reality, and that's why we chose to keep them in, because this is life or death for some people. And the sort of bottom line is we have to learn to trust fat people about their own experiences, that they know their bodies and they know their needs, and that they are capable of having a healthy pregnancy if we allow them access to the treatment that they need. And that's where we have the disconnect, that people were telling us about, you know, there aren't exam tables that would fit their bodies. They have to deliver in separate wards, or the epidural didn't work. And the doctor said, well, I'm just not used to doing an epidural on big girls, or people not being able to get external monitors to work. And so what's implicated here is not, therefore, we need to change our bodies so the equipment works. What we need to change is the equipment and the training. If you can't do a vaginal exam on somebody because of the amount of adipose tissue they have, we are not the problem here. You are the problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's what needs to shift, It's not, you know, we need a systemic solution to a systemic problem.
Yeah, no. And also, I just want to briefly, and it doesn't matter what size people are, right? It does not matter. People deserve evidence-based compassionate care. But I want to notate that within your study, the average weight was 256 pounds. Mm-hmm. So I think so often people have this idea of what fat pregnant bodies look like. And it's those sensationalized bodies in, you know, shows like TLC, which those people are deserving of competent, wonderful healthcare. Absolutely. But we're looking at, you know, what the average size American person who can, person in America who can get pregnant, we're looking at about 37% of people are classified with a BMI over 30, which puts them in that obese category. So almost 40% of people, that is a huge majority. So this is a huge issue. And that people, I think we just have this skewed idea of what obesity and pregnancy looks like. And people accessing, you know, having accessibility to care and to treatment. Some people are just so shocked that they're told that they can't even give birth at certain places because of their BMI when they have never been subjected to bariatric care. There is access to larger blood pressure cuffs. The weight limits on labor and delivery beds are 500 pounds for the bed, and I think it's like 400 pounds for the foot portion. So we actually can serve a lot of patients in larger bodies, but people are made to feel like they can't and they don't have accessibility, which I think has a lot to do with weight bias in maternity care. So again, everyone is deserving to evidence-based competent care, but this is a much bigger issue than I think most people are aware of. So I just wanted to chime in there with that.
Yeah, I think it affects people that don't think they would be affected by it.
Yeah.
But to your point, we should have universal standards of care here that anybody at any point on the weight spectrum can get competent care. And
Absolutely.
So when we're doing this advocacy work, we are advocating for everyone to access this kind of care. Maggie, I feel like I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, I think, you know, one thing that really stood out to me in the research was people getting rejected from infertility clinics. And our second article talks more about infertility or reproductive endocrinologists, you know, different providers. And, you know, that they're given the same dose of infertility meds to all patients. And, you know, they're not adjusting the infertility meds for, you know, body size. And, you know, the one thing Aaron and I have talked about, I'm like, well, we would never do that for cancer drugs. So, you know, why are they not doing it in infertility? And, you know, and I think it's just lack of, you know, doing research or, you know, even wanting to do research that it's just much easier to reject people because it's going to mess up their, you know, their clinics rates or whatever. And it's just, you know, it's just frustrating. Like we even had one example of a woman who was trying to tell the doctor or the nurse that she had to go poop, like she had to go to the bathroom. And, you know, they kept saying like, no, you know, you don't have to go. And, you know, and it's, you know, it's again, like it's telling this woman, like she can't even trust her own body that she's, you know that she has to go to the bathroom, that, you know, the nurse is going to know more about her body than she does. And, you know, that's just unbelievably offensive.
Yes, absolutely. Let's look at the third theme that we have here, the weight normative commentary on fat bodies and how we talk about fat bodies. What are your thoughts there, and what's really stood out to you, the responses from the participants?
Well, one thing, you know, was just the idea that getting pregnant in a fat body is considered irresponsible on the that person is considered to be that. However, if pregnancy or childbirth, if that led to weight loss, then it was, you know, something that was praised by, you know, by the medical profession, you know, like somebody's mother saying to them, like, heavy girls don't always get cute baby bumps, or you look you know, so thin, you know, maybe you should get pregnant again to lose weight. And so, you know, some of these messages or, you know, remarks from strangers are just, you know, feeding into a lot of the stereotypes, right, that we hear about fat bodies and what's considered ideal. One thing that like blew my mind during the study was that there aren't even maternity clothes for people in fat bodies. And I just like, I couldn't believe, like, I just couldn't even wrap my head around that, like, that wasn't an experience that everybody had access to. And so, you know, again, just more of my thin privilege that's not available to everybody.
I think yeah. that was something Maggie learned when I was pregnant and couldn't find maternity clothes. And she was like, what?
I just right. couldn't even, I mean, how, you know, that's like such a rite of passage, you know, in the pregnancy journey to, you know, to be able to get maternity clothes and to have that not be a special experience for somebody is really just really offensive.
Oh, absolutely. And while we have more options online, and I'm thankful that we do, it's still incredibly limited, but to not have that in-store experience, which goes back to something that so many people in fat bodies can, you know, identify with, of going to the mall and having very, very tiny few options. But with pregnancy, it's so much worse. And yet again, I spoke earlier that statistically we know that nearly 40% of people who can get pregnant in their childbearing years are at, you know, those higher weights. So there are a lot of people, and why isn't this talked about, or why aren't people cared about? Yeah, the market is there, and yet we don't provide people with compassion, the tools, the resources they need, and just meeting them where they're at. I found throughout this third theme that assumptions, right? The assumptions we make about people of size. And when I speak to care providers, I always say, you know, the only thing we know by looking at a person in a larger body is that they exist in a larger body. We know nothing else. And the minute we start to make assumptions about nutrition and physical activity and health, we create a barrier where the patient, you know, if you're going to make assumptions about what I hear, you know, an example would be like, oh, you really need to cut out your Pepsi habit. And the person was like, I don't even like to drink soda, but yet this care provider said this to me. So why was I going to listen to any other recommendations they were making about my nutrition when they're just assuming what I eat and what I drink? And we hear this time and time again of how these assumptions really play into how people walk away from that care provider visit and the decisions they make overwhelmingly about their health and wellness because they are made to feel just like crap.
And also kind of like an idiot, because how many times has a doctor tried to talk to you about what it means to walk 3 times a week? Or they'll be like, you know, vegetables are really good for you. It's like, yeah, no, I know that.
Yeah. I'm very much aware. Thanks.
Stupid.
No, yeah.
Yeah. I also was thinking when you were talking, Jen, about shopping for maternity clothes and going to the mall and whatever. It's like, if you wonder why all your fat friends are really into jewelry and shoes and purses, it's because that's what fits us at the mall. Right. And, yeah. You know, with maternity clothes, it's like, I guess I'll order these 5 things I can find online, the only 5 things I can find. But it, yeah. Both of these, I think, just kind of get at the idea that the world is not accessible for fat people. And whether that's maternity care, maternity clothes, you know, competent health care treatment, it can be a hard world to navigate. And we just saw so much contradiction centered on, you just need to be thinner. Whether that was like, get thin so you'll lose weight, or get pregnant so you'll lose weight, or don't get pregnant because that's not responsible.
Breastfeed.
Yeah, breastfeed to lose weight, or you have to have birth control because it would be irresponsible for you to get pregnant. And then on the other hand, we don't believe you'll ever get pregnant because who would have sex with you? You know, it's just like, there's no winning for fat people. No. And the reason is because it's not about reproduction, it's about you being fat. Like, that's what the problem mm-hmm. is in their eyes. And so there just is no winning when mm-hmm. that's ultimately what they're gonna say is the problem.
And there's so many eugenic messages, right? That like, you don't deserve, like that those genes shouldn't be passed on. And, you know, that's like sort of the elephant in the room, right? That people believe those messages.
Yeah.
And I mean, we even had somebody in our study who the doctor wanted to start them on insulin because they might get gestational diabetes. And like, I don't think the patient ever did. And, you know, it's just really,
they assumed they had it.
Yeah. I mean, just really,
I hear that a lot.
Really scary stuff. That's so dangerous for somebody that doesn't.
Yeah. The assumptions.
Need it. I know. I was wondering, one thing I wanted to do is to look up, like, if you're even allowed to take that new sort of trendy weight loss drug, not with
Mounjaro.
It's not safe in pregnancy.
It's not safe in pregnancy. I figured it wasn't, but I was like, I wonder what people who are doing it for, not because they have type 2 diabetes, but for weight loss.
Yeah.
I was just even thinking about, I wondered if they were even able to take it while they were pregnant. I would hope not.
But we even look at metformin that was given to people during pregnancy and that wasn't effective either. So it's a lot of these assumptions and trials on pregnant people, which is disturbing. I know I started my work in 2011 because when I got pregnant, I couldn't find any positive information on how to have a healthy person as, you know, a person of size. There were just all these increased risks listed by all these huge medical organizations and websites that people go to for information. And then the more consumer fun stuff like Baby Center didn't even have pictures of people of size, let alone at the time, very many Black people and people of color. So I wanted to help change this narrative of like, how do we provide people with positive evidence-based information on how to have a healthy pregnancy? And that's what is so frustrating. Like all you're saying about you need to lose weight, people are being told this in pregnancy where the research shows, no, that is not a safe recommendation. No, we shouldn't be trying these drugs. No, you shouldn't be given insulin unless you actually have diabetes or have extreme cases of gestational diabetes, whereas often even gestational diabetes can be managed with nutrition. We are causing so much harm, and yet there's such a lack of, how do we have positive outcomes with even with gestational diabetes? Looking at the research, people with a higher BMI have about an absolute risk of around 17%. So that means overwhelmingly they have the odds of not incurring gestational diabetes. And that's has really been a framework of my work, is how do we provide information to empower people to be proactive? And I'm so thankful for studies like yours that back up the harm that is happening with weight bias. So let's look at shifting that and some more positive outcomes, where your fourth theme of weight inclusive counter narratives was something else that you noted. And there was some beauty and hope that came out of that too.
Well, Jen, as you're talking, it was really beautiful for me to hear that and why you started doing this work, because the papers that Maggie and I are working on now is we asked all of these participants, what's a piece of advice that you would give to someone else in a larger body navigating this space? And several of them, lots of them, talked about finding good information and finding inclusive community online. And several people specifically named your social media accounts and blogs and stuff like that. And so we have empirical evidence for you now that says what you've done for the last 12 years has actually made a difference. Like, you've accomplished that goal, because then people came back and told us, this is where I got good information. And so it was really touching to hear you say that, like talk about your purpose in doing this work, because we're hearing before ever having connected with you that you're doing that. So I love that that came up for us to be able to tell you about that. That paper's not out yet. We're working on it right now. But you and a few other accounts that people specifically said, like, look at these sources for good information.
Well, I'm crying because This is such heart work, right? And I think Erin can speak to this too, like existing in a larger body and fighting just to receive compassion, just to receive evidence-based care. And my whole work started because I had a midwife. When you talk about memorable messages, you know, I had a midwife, not just one, who believed in my body more than I did and who said the most kindest things. And for the first time in my life, you know, at the age of 30, realizing that I was healthy, you know, this was the first care provider was like, you are healthy, like you're doing great, like your body is designed for this. And it is why I do the work I do today, because of those memorable messages and the way I was treated with compassion. And I've so fought to help and put information out in the world so people know the importance of connecting with size-friendly care providers, or people know where they can just find a cute maternity outfit to wear to have photos taken, right? It's sent from those really important things to just the essential things, right, that we are so denied as people of size. So I'm really, really touched. It means a lot to me because this isn't just my job. This is my life's mission, right? And how wonderful, but how sad that my mission is just so people are treated with dignity and compassion and evidence-based care.
Yeah, it feels like a low bar to clear, but that's where we are right now. And so it's important to be doing that work and finding ways to intervene where we can. And honestly, what a lot of people said in this last theme, which was about weight inclusive counter narratives, was people talked about just nobody brought up my weight. And like, that was the message, was it didn't come up. Or they talked about, you know, they referenced bio indicators, like my blood pressure, or, you know, it's like, it's not, we're not asking for any, I don't need a doctor to look at me and go like, you're so beautiful, I love your curve. I don't need that. What I need is for you to not bring it up when it's not relevant, which is most of the time.
Right.
And so I think this set of findings showed us it makes a world of difference to hear a positive message or to just not hear a negative one.
Yeah, to be weight neutral whenever possible, I think, is something that care providers need to hear. And I always talk about also normalize that the conversations that you're having, especially around weight gain and nutrition and physical activity, are conversations you're having with patients of all sizes. There is not one thing that only impacts people of size, right? People of advanced maternal age have almost the same increased risk of people of size. Like, we need to be normalizing this and really have care providers and have a lot more training around them addressing weight bias and addressing racism and addressing the treatment of the LGBTQ plus community. We need to have a lot more work done so people are met where they're at and harm is not occurring.
Yes. And, you know, I think, you know, there is definitely like federal support that's needed. You know, so Erin and I have talked about, okay, like we can share this information with providers, but we need to be going to some of those larger organizations and, you know, talking to them about even the language that they use on their websites and, you know, different places and, you know, really taking it to the next level is a big task for us. But I think we're committed enough to say, like, we have to keep going if we're really going to see the change that we want.
Are you plus size and pregnant or trying to conceive? Do you wonder where you can find cute plus size maternity clothes or when you'll start showing and how to embrace your pregnant body? What about having a healthy pregnancy and how to reduce your increased risk? Find the answers to these questions and so much more within the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook. From nutrition and physical activity to prenatal care expectations and the importance of hiring a size-friendly care provider, you'll not only learn information to help you make informed decisions throughout your pregnancy, but start to develop a new relationship with your body. Download this guide and start using it at any point in your pregnancy. Stop Googling and start feeling empowered today. Use code PLUSMOMMY to get 20% off the My Plus Size Pregnancy Guide and audiobook. What do you want moving forward? And I know, Maggie, you just spoke to that, but let's hear a little bit more. And Erin, like, what are your hopes as well?
Yeah, so we have talked about, and we come from a place of understanding that these issues are deeply ingrained in our systems. And so in our second article, the one more focused on infertility messages, a reviewer asked us, basically, like, can you give some advice to people who are fat who are navigating the system? And so we did, but we added the caveat to say, like, this is not your problem to fix. So here's some advice for you on finding an inclusive provider and on screening questions you can ask providers, but also know we have to intervene at a much higher level because we don't want to continue to give out individual level advice when really it's the system and not the individuals that are broken. So, yes. You know, ultimately we would love to see things like the ACOG guidelines change.
ACOG, yeah.
Yeah. And we also see a lot of intersectionality needed in some of this research. And so we don't know the racial makeup of our sample. We don't know things about SES, socioeconomic status. We have very few sexual and gender minorities in our sample. And we know that the experience in the reproductive healthcare system is not the same for all pregnant people. And yeah. Things like rates of maternal mortality are exponentially higher among Black women than they are among women who are not Black. And so we see a lot of places where we as researchers first need to explore within group differences. So like what's happening for people of different social identities. So that's sort of the next direction that we're going is we're going to start looking at Black women's experiences and then start thinking maybe about like sexual and gender minority experiences and seeing, get some sort of more nuanced understanding. We also are trying to do more advocacy work with some of this. This is a little bit of an uncomfortable space for academics to be a little bit more like public facing. Maggie has done a lot of it. And so she is teaching me a lot about how to get our work out there and why that is important to do. But for us, this part of doing the research really matters because then it can reach people who, one, need to hear these messages. Like this would have been really impactful for me when I was earlier in my reproductive health journey or my sort of like fat liberation journey. You know, like this really would have made a difference for me. But also we want people who have influence over policies to hear what we're saying.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so this is a really important step for us, I think, to accomplish that goal.
Absolutely. You mentioned ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and they had their committee opinion most recently on obesity and pregnancy that came out in 2021, and they've had many throughout the years. But it was interesting to read through it, which is it's behind a paywall, so it's very hard for people to access, even though it's the standards that are set for so many in maternity care. And huge focus on all the increased risk, right, and weight gain recommendations and everything. There was a note of how racism could play into these poorer outcomes, especially for Black people. But there was nothing about weight bias in maternity care, even though by that time there was research available and anecdotally people screaming for decades. And I was really disappointed in that. Every time I read through their updated committee opinion, I hold my breath, fearing that they'll say that there should be an automatic high-risk classification. And that hasn't happened. But they also removed some language that used to be in there stating that the people should receive normal obstetrical care who have a higher BMI just based on BMI alone. But I was disappointed to definitely not see any mention about how weight bias is playing a role in the poorer outcomes that we do see for people in larger bodies. So I love that you said about like, we need to have these conversations and we need to be pushing forward with all of this. very, very frustrating.
We also need more accurate information in their hands. Yeah. Because for time in memoriam, the assumption has been if you are at a higher weight, you are at higher risk. Mm-hmm. And the high risk classification is not mandated by ACOG, but a lot of practices have those officially or unofficially, you know, sort of their high risk cutoff. My dream would be to see us stop using the BMI in this or any health related context, because we know it's actually a really terrible proxy for individual health and was never intended to be used that way. It's just had, you know, really wide uptake from someone who was just sort of like a random Flemish statistician who came up with this. But yeah, I think there's just not good information because people are still working under the assumption that high weight means poor health. And mm-hmm. we're starting to get a much better understanding of all of the intervening variables that are actually causing that relationship between weight and health. And so until organizations like ACOG even have better research in their hands and they're willing to see that corpus of research as credible, those things aren't going to change. And so that's where it comes back to, you know, Maggie and I doing this research and then disseminating it, we hope will start to slowly make change in some of those larger areas, system level areas.
Oh, I know that you will. And I know that this is so impactful and so necessary. And I am so thankful for each of you and the work that you're doing. Erin, I know that this conversation could maybe be polarizing and difficult for people in larger bodies who have been listening to it. Could you maybe speak to the hope that you have from personal experience and this research to someone who has listened through this hour and is just like, oh, this all feels overwhelming, but there's some hope coming out of it. And I if you wouldn't mind, I'd really appreciate that.
Sure. I was always very scared of getting pregnant because of my body. And that changed in the years leading up to my pregnancy, which I'm very thankful for. But what I would have wanted to hear when I was younger was, this is possible for you. You can have a healthy pregnancy, a partner who loves you, not regardless of what you look like, but because of what you look like, or just loves you full stop, and is anxious to raise this child with you. You don't have to have the affirmation from other people to believe in yourself that you are worthy of being a parent, and that your pregnancy can be beautiful and lovely and also incredibly challenging, because being pregnant is hard, but that has nothing to do with being fat. And I just, like, if I could put a hug into words, that's what I would want. Like, what I have always craved is just someone to hug me and, you know, verbally hug me and just say, like, this is fine. You are fine. And you are beautiful, and this is fine, because it just, there's this constant sense of striving when you're fat, striving to be smaller, striving to get people to love you, to prove that you have something else to offer. And we just can stop that and just stop it and just love who we are and let people love us for who we are. And that acceptance of just what I am, what I look like, and who I am, just makes a world of difference for me. And I love being a mom. I love my baby so much, and I'm a good mom, not in spite of being fat or because of being fat. I'm just a good mom to my baby. And I was a good mom to him when I was pregnant with him. And you are too. It doesn't have to be this hard, and people are wrong.
Oh, I feel that.
Yeah.
Yes. I feel that virtual hug so much. Erin, thank you for everything you just said. I think I'll be rewinding it and listening to it over and over again, too, because we all need that reminder. Maggie, could you speak from that perspective of existing in a smaller body, but being, you know, you sent me your bio, and within it you wrote that you're a fat ally. Can you speak to the academics and care providers listening right now from what you've been learning about weight bias and specifically maternity care and fertility care? And what message would you want to say to people that want to do better? And that's why they're listening right now.
I mean, I definitely think healthcare providers, a lot of them don't realize the damage that they're doing. They're just so ingrained in it and feel like they have to, because insurance, or, you know, because of all of the pressures that they're under to give these messages. So I'm not excusing it, but I also understand that they're in a system that this is, that weight bias is a part of it. And I think until that conversation changes, that it'll continue. And
yeah,
you know, I think, you know, from our research, we learned that like providers do want to learn more, and like just even like a short session on this topic would make a huge difference in how they, you know, during residency or during some point of their medical education or continuing education, you know, received these messages that things could be better, you know. But I mean, I definitely think this research has, you know, again, reminded me of some of the painful things that I've said to people that I love, you know, that I've bought into a lot of these messages. And, you know, it's changed how I, you know, hopefully will communicate with my children, with my husband, who's, you know, who struggles with weight. You know, I think the more that we have these conversations, the better people we will be. And, you know, that I'm here to learn, and, you know, how can I be the best, you know, advocate that I can. And, you know, this research has taught me more than I, you know, than I could really give back. And I, you know, just want to keep the momentum going. And so, you know, just really honored that you invited us on this conversation. When I wrote, you know, an email to you, and, you know, you wrote right back, and, you know, Aaron and I were, you know, doing texting, you know, happy dances of, you know, this is really a huge opportunity for us. And so thank you for, you know, for validating, you know, our writing style and accessibility of our research. Like that is really, we don't really get those messages. So, you know, academics don't get a ton of compliments on their research. It's mostly critiques. So, you know, to have somebody who like celebrates it and appreciates it is, you know, really encouraging that we can continue doing this.
Thank you.
Maggie, I will say for you, you're being pretty hard on yourself. You are a wonderful ally to fat people, and there are lessons that you've learned, but if you're a thin person who's hearing this conversation, do what Maggie did, which is like, oh, I shouldn't use the word obese. Okay, tell me a different thing to use. Or it's okay to acknowledge that your fat friend is fat. Like, that's okay to do. And Maggie is so willing to learn and then be supported in the ways that I need support. And that's the kind of thin friend that we need, because we need thin people to do this work too, right? Right. So if you're a thin ally, be a thin ally like Maggie.
I love it. I want to ask you one more question that just came to mind. In the research that you've done so far, is there any negative impacts of addressing weight bias in maternity care and treating people of size with compassion?
Not a bit that we have seen.
Right. Yeah.
I think there is resistance to doing it. And some of that is because you lose things like financial benefits from insurance companies and things like that. But every person, which it's not many, but people who have received compassionate, evidence-based, competent care are better off for it.
Yes, 1,000%. Yeah, because when we look at evidence, we want to look at all factors. And I'm like, I know the answer to this question, but I want to hear the researchers tell me. Yeah. Because ultimately, care providers want healthy outcomes for their patients, right? And patients want healthy outcomes. We both want the same thing. We have the evidence to show harm is occurring. How can we come together to have healthy, positive outcomes, whatever that looks like for the person, but that they walk away from their birth feeling that they were supported and that they were treated with compassion. And that should be the basis for everything, right? And it shouldn't be something that we need to have research to back up that harm is occurring, because everyone should feel supported so we can even have more positive outcomes for people of all sizes during maternity care.
Right. We are all on the side of competent, compassionate care. Yes. And it's just a matter of understanding what that looks like.
Yes. Well, thank you all so incredibly much. I hope anyone listening that has a platform can help amplify your work. Please let the listeners know where they can find you and find your work. I will keep everything in the show notes too at plusmommy.com so you can further dive in and read their excellent, excellent work as well.
Yeah, you can find me on my academic website, which is erinbasinger.com, and on Twitter at Dr. Erin Basinger.
And you can find me on my UNC Charlotte website, as well as I have a website with my research partner, Bethany Johnson, who's a historian, and we co-wrote a book called You're Doing It Wrong, Mothering, Media, and Medical Expertise, a little plug for that. And we have an academic website called Johnson Quinlan Research.
Thank you, Maggie and Erin, for all that you've done and all that you will continue to do. I can't wait to follow your journey and to continue to highlight your work. I deeply, deeply appreciate you both. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you.
All right, friends. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.